Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Say the tropics these days, and history comes to mind. Kipling, pith helmets, Somerset Maugham, and gin tonics. Or, if not history, Club Med, blue water, travel brochures, palmy beaches. The belly of the planet has booming industry, warming, rising seas, war, and tsunamis. But the tropics brings to mind a timeless zone of hammocks and equatorial sun and heat. A torrid zone, in the words of my guest today, British travel writer Alexander Frater. He was born in the Pacific Islands, the son and grandson of missionaries. He spent his life going back to island and jungle and steamy coast. Up next, On Point, following the equator, then and now, with Alexander Frater. Joining me now from London is Alexander Frater. He was, for many years, chief travel correspondent for the London Observer. He's rated one of Britain's top travel writers. His latest book, just published in the U.S., is Tales from the Torrid Zone, Travels in the Deep Tropics. Alexander Frater, thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Tom. Nice talking to you.
I'd like to get a bead on which tropics you're bringing us to here. What tropics? We have the tropics of tsunamis and political upheaval and these days of booming industry, whether it's in South India or some parts of Vietnam. We've got the tropics of epidemics in Africa where Bono and Angelina Jolie show up. What tropics are you taking us to?
I'm taking you to a very personal tropics. It's as you've just indicated in that excellent introduction, if I may say so. I could almost go home, actually, Tom, and leave you to
please,
it.
Please don't.
What I'm trying to do, I mean, I was born in the tropics. I was partially raised in the tropics. I've done probably six great journeys in my life, and all of them, for purely coincidental reasons, happen to be in the tropics. So it's a personal attempt to try and get hold of this huge aspect of the globe. You know, it occupies one third of the globe, and one third of the world's population live there. How on earth do you write a book about that? So I've kept it personal. It's just about the countries I've been to, the people I've met, the kind of adventures I've had, the stories people have told me. So it's just a personal look at this extraordinary part of the world, which, as you say, is very much in the news now for all kinds of reasons, which sort of predate me or post-date me.
Or both. The Independent in London calls you the most engaging of all living travel writers. So we're prepared to take the voyage with you.
That quote cost me that cost me a lot of money.
I'm sure it did. And as it happens, this is a part of the world I know awfully well. You start off in Vanuatu, where I've spent some time, and throughout that South Pacific, Asia, Africa, Central America, it's familiar terrain, but I'm struck again and again at how many ways there are to see it, to slice it these days. There's the travel, you know, there's the tourism slice, there's the epidemic slice, there's the economic slice. Yours, to my ear, harkens back to that kind of Somerset Maugham.
I think that's the kind of era that I come from. I mean, I was born in you mentioned Vanuatu, but when I was born, it wasn't called Vanuatu at all. It was called the New Hebrides.
Yes.
It was one of the strangest little places on earth. It was jointly run by Britain and France. It was a condominium, which was a disastrous political experiment.
Americans know it from James Mitchner's South Pacific, which he essentially said.
That's where all that happened. But you know, this experiment between two sovereign states over in Europe who'd hated each other for 1,000 years still do. Trying to run a small, obscure, difficult group of islands and islanders was catastrophic. I mean, they called it a condominium in London, but locally down there in Port Vila, we called it pandemonium. And everything was duplicated. You had two systems of coinage. You had two systems of postage stamps. You had two police forces. You had two jails. The French one was better because the food was good. And you had two hospitals, the British one and the French one. My father was a Presbyterian missionary doctor.
And your grandfather before him a missionary as well.
And my father ran the British hospital. Mm. And my grandfather before him was not a doctor, just a straight Presbyterian missionary in an island only 20 miles away, on the island of Palma, where he landed in 1900 with his young wife. They'd never been out of Scotland before. And they were met by cannibals, genuine cannibals, who were firing arrows at them and throwing spears at them. And eventually they were allowed ashore for just 1 week. They stayed for 39 years, and my grandfather Morris built 21 churches on that island. And on a smoking marine volcano next door, he built three more.
Mm. So this is very old-school sense of the tropics here.
These are my roots we're talking about now. This is where I sort of come from. So... you might want, why do I write about the tropics? Because, you know, I'm a creature of the tropics.
Well, a lot of people are obsessed. I mean, it lives especially in the winter minds of many people in the north. You look back at all those who love and travel in the tropics and take us back to a time when it was a painter who inspired actually generations after he was there, a rather famous painter. I wonder if you'd read a bit for us from the Torrid Zone, Alexander Frater, there.
Yes.
Page 11 or so. Could you dive in for us?
Yep. I was told you weren't going to give me the page numbers. Well, that's really nice of you. hang on. Right, we're going to have to move this. Page 11. Good.
You're talking there about the sort of tide of people who take in the tropics these days and
there
inspirations for the first of them.
Absolutely. You're talking about
Today Among Our Number.
That's right. Good-o. Today Among Our Number, I have met inadequates and no-hopers, sex tourists, runaways and petty crooks. But there are also yachties, surfers and sun freaks and first-world retirees on underperforming pensions hoping to live well on the low-cost, debt-ridden tropical third world where fruit grows wild by the roadside. All in all, we're a pretty mixed bunch, and Gauguin is our man. Not only did he leave the life we craved, he left behind sublime evidence of what it could be like. How solemn and beautiful he made it. What grace he bestowed on the tropics. Once in Papeete, I boarded a tiny propeller-driven twin otter and flew northeast for 7 hours. It refueled at various atolls en route. The Tahitian pilot using binoculars to make his landfalls, we half-dozen passengers jumping out to hand-pump the gas from drums. Then late in the afternoon, finally descended towards a lofty island, angular and densely wooded. I noted pines on Hiva Oa's crown and at its foot the palm-fringed black volcanic beaches which famously he had painted a luscious pink. Exasperated by Tahiti's petty provincialism, Gauguin sailed off to this obscure outpost in the Marquesas. There, aged 52, he scandalized the French by seducing, then marrying, a 13-year-old Polynesian schoolgirl named Marie Rose. He built his child bride at Villa, the House of Pleasure, and bought her the first pony and trap the island had seen. The authorities promptly fined him for driving without lights. Creating his final pictures, he also began drinking himself to death. Ben Varney's road store across the road supplied him with absinthe and 600-litre hogsheads of claret. He kept his absinthe down a well to chill it. Today the house, along with Varney's store, has reverted to the forest, but the well remains, as does the magazine Pierre Char, a two-story trading emporium where he and Marie Rose did their household shopping and which, during my visit, received a shipment of Gauguin T-shirts. Suddenly, right across the island, people were walking around in his masterpieces. Otherwise, only his grave provided tangible evidence of his presence. Fashioned from slabs of heavy, rust-colored rock, it had a gnarled, frangipanied tree growing from its head, and putting forth so many flowers, it may have taken root in his skull.
Alexander Frater, reading from his book Tales from the Torrid Zone, travels in the deep tropics, so we get a sense of kind of the poetry and the imagery that lies back in the root ball of your family's engagement there. When you look out today, do you still see it as Gauguin tinged, or is it now, you know, tsunamis and Bangalore calling centers?
That's a good point, Tom. For me and for people of my generation, it will always be Gauguin tinged. The awful things that have happened to the tropical region recently, unspeakable things. That doesn't remove the great things that went before. And Gauguin was one of the great things. I mean, he was a disaster as a human being. He was a terrible man. But my goodness, he could paint. And he left some masterpieces behind that have sort of delineated that part of the tropics, that time in the tropics. And it was a sort of tail end of that, when I was sort of born into the end of that Gauguin era. So it's very important for me. For younger people, maybe they'll think, well, yeah, okay, what's going on in Bangalore is a lot more important. And of course, they're right.
Yeah, and though some rough things in tsunami and war and pestilence, also some very exciting things in that industrial leading edge. I wonder if it one day rolls over the Somerset Maugham Gauguin view of the tropics and leaves it behind.
I don't know. You see, this is all very interesting, because my vision of the tropics is a direct variance with the vision you've just talked about. You know, you're talking about the sort of southern Indian people with their cutting edge IT stuff. Is that correct?
Sure, sure. And right there in your Tropic of Cancer, smack dab in the middle
of
it. I really did, in reading this, wonder how you pull them together, whether you see the past right through the headlines or the present in the tropics where you've spent so much time, or whether you see yourself time traveling.
Well, that's a bit of everything, really. I mean, time traveling. As I said, I was born there. I was partially brought up there, and I became a journalist here in London. And I had the great good fortune to have a succession of editors who were prepared to send me on assignments back to the tropics. So cliche of the day coming up, Tom.
Okay,
it's a very complicated, complex region, and although it has many things in common, there are things that it does not have in common. I mean, you have these absolutely brilliant southern Indian whiz kids who are doing the most amazing things. And then you have the people of the islands of Oceania who just haven't had those educational opportunities, who haven't had that kind of intellectual stimulus, and who haven't been able to sort of produce the kind of brilliant work that the people in the Indian subcontinent are doing. So, then you can go to the Amazonian Indians. They're all part of the same region, and they all have different lives and different aspects pull them all together and say this is what tropical people are like is virtually impossible. You can't do it.
Mm. So, nevertheless, it can sort of hit some people and never let them go. You talk about there's a phrase, le coup de bambou. What's that?
Le coup de, yeah. You see, it's the French. When I started my book, I was looking around the shelves of the London Library for other books on the tropics, and I could only find two, and they one was written by a French school teacher back in 1958.
You mean that tried to take on the whole thing? Because of course there's so many.
Exactly. But he was writing it for school kids, and then there was the wonderful Claude Lévi-Strauss, you know, the great social anthropologist, who wrote a wonderful book called Tristes Tropiques, which came out in 1973. So there's just. There's very little information looking at the tropics as a whole, and if any of your listeners could call in with suggestions, I'd be immensely grateful. I mean, I was brought up to believe that People who live in the tropics. You know, my mother hated the tropics. She loathed the tropics, and she said that
when it gummed up her piano keys, she called it jungle music. Yeah,
that's right.
She didn't want to be the missionary's wife after a while.
That's right. That's right. And she said that everyone born in the tropics, we all had short attention spans. We found concentration difficult. Any distraction from work would be welcome. I mean, two raindrops going down a window pane. You know, that would. And she just felt that we tropical people were sort of one beat behind the rest of humanity, you know. And there's the French have a saying for this. Getting back to what I was saying earlier, it's le coup de bambou, which is just sums it up nicely. We are perhaps one beat behind everyone else. I mean, can I just tell you a very quick anecdote?
Please, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, there's what sort of sums up the tropics perfectly for me is a tribe that inhabits the Kasai Valley in Zaire, and they were famous for they're called the Lelés, the lazy Lelés, and they were famous for awarding themselves more public holidays than any other people on earth. Now, I've got a typical week in a busy September planting season for the Lelés went like this. Sunday, tell you, incidentally, that every third day was a day of rest, okay, along with Sundays, that was a day off, and the day following the departure of any visiting personage. So
don't rush it.
This is how a week goes. Mm. Sunday, day off, okay? Monday, work. Tuesday, day off in honor of a VIP who had left on Monday. Wednesday, day off. But after lunch, an important agricultural scientist turns up to inspect the fields. Thursday, work cancelled due to rain. Friday, day off in honour of the agricultural scientist who had left on Thursday. Saturday, day off. So that's a typical sort of Lele week.
Okay, now let's just track straight on around the tropics from there. You talk about the lazy Lelés. It's got a very colonial ring to it. Here we are in India. Freighters going out, you know, by the mountain full of...
I know.
Vietnam just on fire with economic activity.
I know. We got all
of that at once.
But I'm talking about... I mean, we were talking about the sort of different aspects of the tropics. Yeah. I mean, you've got Southeast Asia, and you've got India, which have traditionally had a different sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Then we're looking at Africa, places like Africa and the islands of Oceania, where they don't have the sort of educational opportunities. And they are not, as I mentioned earlier, they are not doing the kind of extraordinary things that are going on in the places you've just mentioned.
Alexander Freider...
I don't know what the answer is, but they both belong to the same region.
Yeah.
And I know that the lazy Lelés, I mean, that has a terrible colonial ring to it, but I'm just quoting from one of the books I mentioned to you.
Well, we're looking through space here, geography and time and cultural... perception all at once with Alexander Freider. His book is Tales from the Torrid Zone. And yes, indeed, there are a lot of listeners who would like to share tales with you. Let me go to one right now. Darius is calling from Boston. Hi, Darius. You're on the air with Alexander Freider.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Darius.
I am originally from Mauritius, and I was just wondering if you had the opportunity to stop there and what was your impression?
I stopped at Mauritius, yes, and I absolutely loved it. I was slightly... what bothered me slightly was the fact that tourism is really seems to be taking over your island.
And here we are, east of Africa, east of Madagascar, way out in a lonely spot.
We're out in the Indian Ocean now, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's Darius's island. It's an extraordinarily beautiful island, but there's some very very expensive exclusive hotels. I mean, you're getting minor members of the British royal family going out there. You're getting lots and lots of rich Russians who turn up with briefcases full of dollars and they know two phrases. It's either royal suite or best accommodation, and there are certain hotels they go to, and it's champagne all the way, and it's all paid in cash. So that worries me slightly, you know, whether your government will have the courage to sort of stand up to these people and make sure that they don't interfere with your way of life.
How about it, Darius? What about your tropical island in Mauritius? Are you worried about that tourism influence or welcoming the cash it brings?
Yeah. It's I know they have hotels that goes up to, I don't know, $30,000 a day. It's very scary. It's part of the, I think it's a fourth pillar of the economy, as they call it, because they have been pushing offshore banks and also information, I mean, IT with India is growing exponentially. And it's a very fragile balance between the ecosystem, because tourists right now, I think it's almost 900,000 tourists per year, and the total population is 1.3 million.
And Doris, let me ask you, if I may, when you hear Alexander talking about people in the tropics, and he includes himself here being a step behind in that sweltering heat and so on, is that offensive to you? Do you welcome it? Do you say, and good thing too, the rest of the world moves too fast? Or when we're talking about IT, is that even relevant anymore?
You know, it's shocking. A lot of people do not know, but Mr. Fredo visited Mauritius, and we have a 100% free educational system and free health care.
Wow.
And it's the literacy rate is 98%.
Sounds pretty good.
Darius, it's a fantastic place. And it's also where you had the last dodo, wasn't it?
Yes. You know, the 12th of March was the 39th independence anniversary. We became independent from England. And everybody is multilingual, and it's also a very diverse place with Christian, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, everything coexists. You know, I said to people, I went to Catholic school, I live in a Muslim community, and I'm Hindu.
So I don't know if it's a step behind or a step ahead there, Darius. It's wonderful.
It's a microcosm, a lab in how people can coexist regardless of race, religion, whatever you want to call it. There's no problem, and it's a different experience for me here, the concept of race and religion. I grew up with all that, and I have no problem whatsoever. And also, what comes first back home is being a Mauritian and progress. Anything else, the belief in, you know, religion, God, that is secondary as much as it's important.
Darius, you carry the flag well for Mauritius, and we're very happy to hear from you on it. We've got others I want to turn to as well, if I may, but thank you for calling. Let me go to Nashville, Tennessee, and George. George, where will you take us in the tropics?
The Philippines. I spent 3 years in the Philippines, Tom, and back in the late 70s, early 80s, and I saw a culture that was being corrupted unintentionally by the best intention by the American government and the American monies that was pouring into it.
Were you in business or the service, or what took you there, George?
I was in the service. I was in the military. Mm-hmm. But I was able to travel around and see a lot of it. And the people were wonderful, moral, great character, just as friendly to a fault. And yet, because we backed the wrong political horse...
This was the time Ferdinand Marcos was rising up, of course.
And corruption, and we just poured money into the area without any thought of the culture and how the culture would... It would impact the culture. And I, what I saw was, because I was, one of my jobs was the VD control officer for the base, is that we corrupted the culture just by our presence.
Mm.
And it was sad to see wonderful people, and they were, Philippine people are wonderful people.
But George, you raise a great question that goes right across the region, not just the Philippines. Let me put it to Alexander Frater about... You know, you described the briefcases full of cash from Russia, but it's a lot of cash and culture coming from all over the temperate zone flowing in to the tropics. I guess this is inevitable part of globalization.
Indeed,
but do you see lost with it, as George did in the Philippines?
I don't think so. I think this is inevitable. I mean, you know, the balance has to be maintained, and we have... We have one part of the tropics which are... doing very well, financially successful, and money coming in from the rest of the planet, and it's absolutely right that that balance should be maintained, that it should go on elsewhere. I mean, I know the Philippines very well; it's another favorite place of mine. And I agree with what your guest has just said. But there is a sort of the other thing about, you know, America. There's a very strong historical link between the USA and the Philippines.
Well, it was going, a colony,
you know, going back to, you know, century before last.
And still, you write through the book how that dropping down with the big capital from the north or south, if it's Australia, can really put a huge thumbprint in these cultures. Not always a great one. The gated walls of the Club Med on the other side, you may find a very different world, in some ways lifted up by those tourism dollars, and others put down.
Yes, and it's a very complicated area. I was talking tourism dollars. I was staying on an island in the Southwest Pacific quite recently, and I was talking an extraordinarily beautiful island. I'm not going to name it, but I was talking to a senior chief, and I stupidly said I very much hope this will remain unspoilt. And he gave me a flinty look, and he said, "You mean our children should go on dying from malaria?" And that's really that puts everything in a nutshell. That's the crux of the matter. We Westerners can come along to these beautiful places and say, stay just the way as you were, just the way you are. They want the kind of lives we've got, and they feel that tourism is the way forward. I mean, this chap said to me, back in England, do you have a car? And I said, yeah, I have a car. He said, can you drink the water back in England? And I said, yeah. He said, did your kids go to college? I said, yeah, they did. And he said, no, nobody on this island has ever been to college. Now, so you know, we it's up to us. Tourism is the answer. It's the answer. The problem is that you get lazy governments who regarded as the be-all and end-all cure, you know, let the tourists in and we'll get nice and rich and we don't have to do anything for it. Or you get sort of thoughtful governments who say tourism could be useful, but it's not going to blanket out our own way of life, our traditions, our present industry and what we're doing, and we'll keep it very, very well controlled. And that's the kind of tourism in the torrid zone that I'm personally looking for.
Of course, you've been a travel writer all your life, and you're shielding the name of this island from us. But you've made a career of opening up islands to newspaper readers in London.
But I'm not going to tell you the name of this island.
Alexander Fritter, I wish you'd take us up a river here or two. You've got a little passage from Burma, Myanmar. Lots of people not traveling there these days, but you were there and out on the Irrawaddy River. I wish you'd read a bit for us.
River, yes, indeed, yeah. Okay, I was on. I was,
set us up, yeah.
Yeah, I was on a river steamer traveling from Mandalay down to Yangon, Rangoon, as it used to be called. I was traveling with a photographer friend, and we were the first people to have done that trip since the last war.
What year was this then?
This was sort of late 80s, 1980, I don't know, 88, 89, something like that. But we were on this remarkable little ship, and I'll just read this, Tom. The pilot sat with bare feet. We're just getting on the ship at Mandalay. I should add here, okay? The pilot sat with bare feet, resting on the wheel's lower spokes, one hand clasping a truncheon-sized cheroot, the other a tin bowl for the ash. There was little conversation between the two men. I should add, the other guy was the captain. They are listening to the bow wave, David explained quietly, David being my interpreter. When it grows soft, it means the water is getting shallow. When it vanishes altogether, you're in trouble. And he is using his feet on the wheel because the steering wheel on these old T-class ships is so heavy, you need the full power of your leg and thigh muscles. Aboard an acre-sized bamboo raft, a woman lit a breakfast fire. Two men smoked outside a thatched hut. A small girl knelt at the edge, washing her face. "Teak," said David. Under the bamboo, chained logs are drifting down to the sea for export. You'll also see plenty of jar rafts, bamboo platforms built over thousands of clay cooking pots. The trouble with them is that when they go aground, the jars break. Now the Irrawaddy was beginning to bustle, old country craft laden with cargo and driven by ancient thumping engines lumbered by, trailing veils of blue fumes. A massive pusher tug shoved a barge of crude oil up to Mandalay. A local ferry cut diagonally through the traffic, carrying a lorry and two oxen, and all over the place fishing skiffs ran before the breeze with patched sails billowing like iridescent butterfly wings. Now the breeze blew fitfully, but at any moment might grow into a gale-force wind. These high-sided steamers could be capsized by the impact, so skippers had to keep an eye constantly peeled for telltale spirals of dust approaching across country. If you spotted one, the rule was simple. Run for the nearest bank and get your passengers ashore as fast as they could be urged to jump.
Alexander Frater, reading from his Tales from the Torrid Zone. They're headed up the Irrawaddy from Mandalay. Now, of course, you know there have been calls for people not to go to Myanmar, to Burma. Aung San Suu Kyi in house arrest there for years, an authoritarian regime. As a travel writer who went out to see all things, what did you advise your readers over the years when it came to, I mean, it's absolutely alluring at the level of, you know, romance. It's exotic. Who wouldn't want to be there? But then there's a political reality too. How do you address it?
This is the great Burmese conundrum, actually. And I had the privilege to meet Aung San Suu Kyi's husband up at Oxford some years ago, and he said, "Tell your readers not to go. Just stay away." And I think he's right. I mean, anyone going to Burma today is demonstrating to the regime that some sort of tacit support for the dreadful things they're doing. The counter argument to that is if you do go to Burma, you are not, you, as well as supporting the regime with your money, you're also demonstrating to the Burmese people that they haven't been forgotten. And that's very important.
We've got a lot of listeners who'd like to speak with you. Let's go to Karen in Maynard, Massachusetts. Hi, Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was in the Peace Corps in 1994 in Gabon, Central Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And so that was right on the equator. And my images of the tropics are very different from many of your listeners, I'm sure. One of the things I remember is just being so hot that I could barely move, and your comment about the rain, just watching two raindrops strung, that really hit a chord for me, because I would just sit and watch the river flow.
In Gabon, you're really talking right on the equator, smack dab through the middle of the country.
I was just south of the equator.
Yeah.
And I would just sit, and it was around 1 o'clock in the afternoon when it was so hot you couldn't move. You would just watch the river flow because you wouldn't want to move.
I know that feeling well, but what, do you have a question in there for Alexander, Karen?
Yeah, so one of the questions that I had was just what are some of the biggest contrasts? Because where I was very remote, and there were places that I visited where very few people had ever been outside of Gabonese people.
Mm-hmm.
Biggest contrast between some of the places you've been to with the tourism versus just utter remoteness.
Oh, gosh. Advance notice of that question would have been very useful, actually. I don't know. What you mentioned then, sitting there, feeling the heat. I mentioned earlier that I'd done a series of six or seven great journeys or good journeys in my life, and they'd all, for various coincidental reasons, been in the tropics. One of them was following the Indian monsoon, which is, I'm sure you know, is a great rain-bearing wind that starts at the southern tip of India and progresses all the way up to the Himalayas, where it blows itself out. And it, on the way, it just brings rejuvenation and joy all the way up India, and I'm sure that something like that would have helped you. As regards your question, where the most obscure, difficult places, I think probably right up in the very, very northern part of India, in areas that the Delhi authorities don't really like you to get to, such as, for example, various bits of Assam. They're the surprising places.
Just about out of your tropics at that point, too. Let's go to Charleston, South Carolina, and Anne. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question for your guest. In 1964, I did a trip up the Torquentines, which is a tributary of the Amazon left from Belém. It was an independent travel, totally independent, and I went up on a local mail boat.
Place that for us in the Amazon Valley. How far west is that? Are you near the borders of Brazil there, Anne?
Oh, we're quite in Brazil, and actually the Belém, where we boarded the boat, was at the mouth of the Amazon.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so we went upstream and then cut off into the Torquentines. The mail boat took passengers, of course. They took some goods, and they took the local mail, and we stopped at all the mail villages, at all the little villages to deliver the mail. And normally stayed overnight. So the trip was about 10 days up and back, and we really had a chance to socialize with the people. I was interested to see that the Dutch priest, normally each village had a priest, the Dutch priest as it happened, who spoke some English and listened to the World Service to pick up information. So they were able to show us around, though, because we didn't speak Portuguese.
But you're talking the 1960s, maybe 40 years, a lot of changes in the Amazon Valley since then.
That's exactly right, and that's my question for your guest, because, the whole way of life has been so radically changed since I made the trip.
Roads in, forests down in many areas.
Exactly, corporations, and how does your guest, or what is your guest take on that? Because it's a really valuable. It's not only valuable because I love the tropics, but it's also valuable because it's the place where we gather the moisture for the whole world. Sort of.
That's right. That's right. And that's a very good question, actually. I've spent time. Did you get to Manaus as a matter of interest?
No, we didn't. That was our original hope, but we didn't make it, and that's why we have to take the other trip. But it was very interesting because it was very primitive. I know about Manaus.
I got up as far as Manaus. Didn't get any further, unfortunately. But my next big push is going to take me up to the Andes, hopefully. But I talk to people, local people, and they're seriously worried at what's going on. And I mean, it's become a cliche now, the amount of Amazonia that's being burnt down every day. But for goodness sake, they're seeing the smoke clouds over Amazonia, over Antarctica, you know? It's becoming critical. And I was talking to people who were telling me about big Russian helicopters that the timber people have bought in, and these things can go into the middle of the rainforest, where trees which up till now have been protected by distance, in other words, they're totally inaccessible, these enormous machines can fly in and actually pull them out of the ground, you know? So wonderful trees are going to be hauled out and stuck on boats and sent down river and sent across to Japan to be turned into chopsticks, or across to Europe to be turned into chairs. And it's all very worrying. I talked to one man in Manaus who said, you come back in 30 years, this is all going to be golf courses. Amazonia is going to be golf courses. And, you know, tongue-in-cheek slightly, but not so tongue-in-cheek.
Instead of rainforest, which we may just need.
Well, indeed.
Let's go to Spokane, Washington, and Karen. Hi, Karen. You're on the air with Alexander Frater.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I've been very interested in the conversation this morning. I'm quite appalled by the modern global economy. Even being 60 years old, I'm embarrassed about the exploitive trade policies, the environmental crises I see, the social injustices, warfare. And if these folks are not on board, hooray for them.
But what about the island chief? What about the island chief that Alexander Frater quotes saying, "Without your tourism, my kids still get malaria."
Yeah, that's
hooray.
It.
I don't like the ship or the destination I can see from the top decks. Mm. And quite frankly, my question for your guest is, what wish does he have for his beloved tropics on the rising seas, as you said, Tom, of climate change?
Alexander Freder?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, one of the reasons, I may have mentioned this earlier, actually, one of the reasons I wrote this book was for my grandchildren, because I want them to know what this area of the world was like now, and you know, in 2006, 2007. What is going to be like in 30 years with what's going on in climate change? I have no idea. I mean, are there going to be icebergs in Fiji? I just don't know.
Do your island friends speak of it? Are they worried about it, obsessed by it?
No, speak of it. They're terrified, Tom. A lot of these low-lying islands in the Southwest Pacific are being flooded. Come back in 10 years, they'll be gone. You know, there are quite a number of largely well-populated islands in the Southwest Pacific where the sea is coming up and up and up, and already they're making arrangements to decamp and go off to New Zealand, and they're doing negotiations with the New Zealand government and the Australian government, you know, for help us for God's sake, because in 10 years we'll all be underwater. So it's crisis time down there, I tell you.
I spent some time in Nauru, where they're looking to move the whole population off island, potentially.
Nauru.
Nauru, yes.
Yeah. Well, that's the island built
with bird droppings over eons.
The bird droppings island. Yes. Right. That's all the bird droppings have all been mined out now, and but they've got an awful lot of money, haven't they?
Yes, but when the sea rises, it rises on all shores.
So the sea rises, and the Nauruans will just go off and get themselves another island, I guess, with a few hills.
Let's go to Betsy in Sharon, Massachusetts. Hi, Betsy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I went on vacation years ago to a Club Med in Haiti, and I was struck. We landed in Port-au-Prince and drove across the island, and I was very much struck by not only the physical beauty of the place, but the dire poverty I witnessed along the way. And I have to say, it very much tainted my week as I lay in my chaise overlooking this magnificent ocean.
Yep.
With my little drink with a pineapple with an umbrella, I couldn't help but think what it took to get there and what kind of people were living directly outside the club. And my question is there a way that tourism can coexist in these kinds of magnificent places that have so much poverty, where the local economy and the community is fed by the tourism?
Alexander Freder?
Good question. I'm getting lots of good questions. That's a cracker, that one. I think the I know exactly what you mean. There's something bewitching about the tropics. You go in there and you're seduced by the color and the movement and the energy. And then you go to your hotel and they close the gates and you sit there with your drink. And meanwhile, you wonder what on earth's going on outside. I don't know. I don't know what the solution is, to be honest.
When you go back to Vanuatu, islands of your birth, you go well beyond the resort gates there. You describe the kind of reception back on the island where your grandfather was, where your father was. Do you see a way of life, an outlook that will survive the tempests we're hearing today thrown at it?
At the moment, to be honest, this could upset some of my friends back in Vanuatu. I really don't see what the future holds. I mean, the future, they say it's tourism. There's some industry, you know, that start. We haven't got the sort of Southeast Asian revolution happening yet, but it could happen. They still have assets. They have timber, they have minerals, there's still some left. I mean, we Europeans have been ripping these people off for the last 1,000 years, you know. Our behavior towards them has been absolutely disgraceful. And they will talk about it. They'll tell you how they feel, but there's still something left, and hopefully, you know, they will get the kind of educational facilities. I mentioned earlier that the chap who said, you know, we don't have our kids don't go to college. We haven't, you know,
but bring them to schools and get in the grain. Our time grows short. We appreciate your big loving wave toward the tropics, Alexander Freder. The book is Tales from the Torrid Zone. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at Acura.com/RDX.